This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Choosing a Supreme Court nominee is one of the most important and enduring actions a president can take. The choice can have an impact on society long after a president has left office. Given the advanced ages of some of the members of the court, John Paul Stevens is 84, Chief Justice William Rehnquist turned 80 last week, and Sandra Day O'Connor is 74, chances are good that whoever is elected president next month will be appointing the next member of the Supreme Court. Even one justice departing could mean a shift in the way the court rules on issues such as affirmative action, abortion rights, and the federal versus state powers. Even if that doesn't happen, the next president will pick dozens, if not hundreds, of federal district court and appellate court judges, and they too can have a profound effect on our society. With the stakes so high, we want to discuss with you and our guests the future of the Supreme Court after the November election. During the program, we'll hear from two legal scholars who have differing views on how the direction of the High Court could change depending on who's in the Oval Office. But especially we want to hear from you. Are you taking the future of the court into account when you consider who you'll vote for next month? If so, why? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And with us here in the studio to guide us through some of these discussions is David Savage. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Joe.
So it seems every election year a big deal is made out of what kind of justices a candidate for president would appoint. Is this year really any different than any other? Or are they always somebody who's either ready to retire or thinking about retiring or aging in some way or another?
Well, unfortunately, you must be remembering the fact that those of us who cover the Supreme Court have written that story a number of times. We wrote it in 1996. We wrote it in 2000. In fact, nothing happened. No one stepped down. There's been no change in 10 years. But with that record of being wrong, I'm going to write again that this election probably will have a big impact on the future of the court. And it could be just one change or two. I think the likelihood is that Chief Justice Rehnquist, as you said, who just turned 80, will step down in the next 4 years. John Stevens, who's 84 and the most remarkable and energetic 84-year-old you would ever encounter, the numbers would say he will leave. I wouldn't necessarily bet on that, but I do think the likelihood is that the chief will retire, particularly if President Bush is reelected. And one change, as you say, can make a big difference. Rehnquist was appointed in the fall of 1971.
Wow.
You know, he's in his 33rd year, so you can't even guess frequently what the issues are going to be when the justices are chosen. Nobody in 1971, the big issue was crosstown busing, for example.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
what everybody was focused on. And then the death penalty. But 20, 30 years down the road, you can't even guess what the big issues are going to be. But the person who's chosen, Rehnquist has had a consistently conservative view all those years. He was exactly what President Nixon wanted. He's sort of lived up to the billing of a staunch conservative. And presumably, President Bush would try to pick somebody similar. I would think John Kerry, if he were elected, would pick some quite different type of justice, and it would have sort of unforeseen consequences for quite a few years.
Is it more or less significant that the Chief Justice might step down? I mean, how important a role is that? And I guess the corollary to that is, does it necessarily mean that the Chief Justice is selected from the sitting judges, or could the new president just pick a new Chief Justice?
The new president could pick a new Chief Justice from outside the court. That's actually more common than not. Dwight Eisenhower picked Earl Warren, who was the governor of California. Nixon picked Warren Burger, who was an appeals court judge here in Washington. Rehnquist was elevated, but that's actually rather unusual. And I think most people think no one within the current court will be elevated, even if President Bush is reelected. As far as the importance of the Chief Justice, a lot of people use the phrase sort of first among equals. I think the Chief Justice is more important than every ordinary justice. If you ask Rehnquist, who always say, I only have one vote, and my colleagues don't listen to me. But in fact, I think he does have quite a bit of impact that you would never see in sort of setting the agenda for the court. The court gets 150 appeals come in the front door every week, and Rehnquist has sort of the first cut about saying, what issues should we take up? He sends around a list of cases to be discussed. So he has a lot of effect, I think, in sort of setting the agenda for what the Supreme Court is going to decide. And you never know that. It's not a matter of public votes or whatever. But I think a Chief Justice who's smart and has a very clear view of the law can have a big impact on the court, much more than one justice.
We're talking about the Supreme Court and what the future of it may be. My guest this hour is David Savage. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And, of course, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And let's take a call now from Josh in Provo, Utah. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
What's your question?
Well, actually, I have a comment. Myself, being a very conservative Republican, especially on social issues, you talked about whether people would vote on the fact that our next president would choose judges. And for me, that's probably the only thing I'm voting on this year.
Really, the only thing? And why is that?
Hallmark issues. Well, as a conservative Republican, especially on social issues, there's actually a lot of things I think that Bush has done out to agree with, and in terms of spending or programs or whatever. In the aggregate, I like him as a president, but the most important thing to me is to have judges in the country that will make decisions that I would agree with in terms of where our country's going to go on social issues. So that would include homosexual marriage rights, abortion issues, and as you mentioned, these are some of the things that are going to be hotly debated in the next 4 years, especially in our courts. And the judges have a unique opportunity to make decisions that pretty much become law as they set different precedents. And those are hard to overturn, and they're hard to legislate against, because once you've set a precedent for a certain issue, that just becomes almost tantamount to a law. And so for me, that's really important, is that the social climate of our country go a certain way. I'm very conservative, and I feel that way. And the judges are going to have a great impact on that. And so our next president's going to appoint those judges, and that's why I'm voting.
Okay. Well, Josh, appreciate that call. And as it happens, we have someone on the line that actually comes from your point of view. He's from his office in Chicago, Stephen Presser. He's a law professor at Northwestern University School of Law and legal affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. Welcome.
Thank you, Joe. It's nice to be with you.
So I don't know if you heard that last call, but...
Yes, I heard Josh's comments. I'd put it slightly differently, but he's on the right track. One of the things that we have to consider is what kind of people the president would appoint, and we know that George Bush is on record as saying that he'd appoint justices like Scalia and like Thomas, and those are the two who believe that it's not the job of the court to make social policy, but it's the job of the court to administer and interpret the law. And I'd prefer to put it that way rather than the way your caller Josh did.
But isn't there an inevitability in there being social consequences from the way you interpret the law? I mean, as we were starting off the program, we were talking about the big issue facing the court in the 70s was crosstown busing. And certainly someone's social context would seem to affect the legal climate in which he makes a decision.
Well, of course, there's social impact. But the real question to be asked is, does the court have the competence to make decisions in that area, or are they better left to the more popular branches of government? And I think what happened with busing, what happened with inner-city schools, and what's happened whenever the court tries to apply social science leads one to think that these are issues that need to be more carefully thought through by legislatures.
Now, you decry the belief that some people you've used this notion of a living constitution.
Yes.
But don't the changing times, I mean, don't we need something like that? I mean, if you go back, I just was revisiting the Constitution, where they still talk about the need for returning runaway property,
well,
as they were calling it.
Well, we do have something to deal with that, and it's called the amendment process.
Right.
And the correction for the pro-slavery provisions that you mentioned are the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And when the people themselves can make those decisions, they have more staying power and it leads to less trouble.
Why do you think on this, I don't know if you've thought about this issue or not, but we haven't heard a lot about this from the candidates themselves. I wonder if you've thought about why that is.
Well, I suspect that the base for both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, know what the positions of their candidates are. And right now, a calculation has probably been made by the campaigns that Iraq and taxes and other issues are more important for firing up the base and getting them to the polls, or at least for changing the minds of swing voters. The judicial issue requires a lot of explanation and requires you to talk about judicial philosophy, and is, I think, less of an issue that lends itself to sound bites than some of these others.
Okay, let's hear from our listeners. Again, our number is 800-989-TALK, and let's go to Jim, who's on the road near Detroit. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. My question, basically, or my statement, is just the opposite of the gentleman that was just there. I would not vote for George Bush based on his selection of leaning right-wing judges. A judge, a justice, should be a fair and impartial representative. He should be able to look at both sides of an issue. It is not something that a president uses to enforce basically values that he cannot sell otherwise to the people of the United States.
Is that something I can comment
on? Yes, Jim, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Professor.
Jim actually is absolutely right. But the point here is not which way does a judge lean. It's whether a judge is bent on making social policy in a way that doesn't allow the popular branches of government to do it. Your caller is absolutely right. What's needed is judges who are objective, who attempt to interpret law rather than to legislate, and I think his description of the judging function is absolutely correct.
But wouldn't you say, just looking at some of the people that the president has appointed to other federal courts, not, of course, the Supreme Court, that the objection to them has been their political philosophy or even their, if you prefer, their legal philosophy?
Well, there's an attempt
or ideology. Yes.
Yeah, there's an attempt to tag them with what some of the Democratic senators call judicial ideology. But the truth of the matter is that I think these people that the president has appointed to the lower federal courts are more in the mold of an objective interpreter of the law, as your caller suggested, than anything else.
I'm wondering if I can ask David Savage to join in on this discussion. He's the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. What do you think of what Professor Presser is saying here?
I think in most situations, Professor Presser is correct. That is, the liberal justices are more likely to sort of strike down laws that they think violate some fundamental right, but not all the time. Let me give you an example. 2 years ago, the two big cases in the spring were the gay rights case from Texas, whether Texas could arrest homosexuals at home and charge them with a crime.
Lawrence versus Texas.
And then the big affirmative action dispute from Michigan,
right.
In that case, Justices Scalia and Thomas would have overturned the judgment of the people who were running the University of Michigan. The Michigan State Legislature could outlaw race-based affirmative action in its higher education system. The leaders of the university could outlaw affirmative action, and they didn't do it. Scalia and Thomas would have handed down a ruling across the board saying no use of race in any public university. That's a pretty big change.
Well, we've got to take a short break here. I understand, Professor Presser, you have to leave, so I'll thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're talking about the future of the Supreme Court, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email at totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about the future of the Supreme Court. The current 9 justices have been together for 10 years, the longest the High Court has gone without a new member since 1823. How important is it to you who the president is when it comes to the Supreme Court? Are you taking this into account when you consider who you'll vote for next month? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. With me here in Studio 3A is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And David, I wonder, you know, I asked Professor Presser just now why this hasn't become an issue on the campaign trail, and he said it's because both the supporters of these two candidates know where these two stand. Is that your impression, too? I mean, is it sort of surprising to you that this hasn't come up more often?
I think it's a little bit surprising. I think it's possible that it may come up in the next debate when they turn to domestic issues. But I think the professor's view is correct, is that both candidates, both parties think our base knows where we stand. George Bush mentioned that comment about Scalia and Thomas as being his favorite justices early in 2000, before the general election campaign, and everybody on the right and everybody on the left remembered it. It's been cited over and over again. In other words, he didn't go into a long discussion about the Supreme Court. He just said, my favorites are Scalia and Thomas, and that sort of signaled to everybody what his view was. John Kerry has also said very little, but the women's rights groups, the abortion rights groups, all those groups on the left, I think, are very fired up because they know what's at stake, even if, you know, candidate Kerry doesn't say much about it during the general election campaign.
Okay, well, let's hear your thoughts on this and any other question relating to the Supreme Court that you might like to bring up. Anita in Washington, D.C., welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on your show.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that I'm a person with a disability, and unfortunately, there's not much talk about those of us with disabilities. I'm worried that there are a lot of the lower court justices and some of the Supreme Court justices are watering down the Americans with Disabilities Act, and therefore kind of watering down the civil rights of people with disabilities like myself. And so I am inclined to look at the way, you know, it will be a factor in my choosing, you know, which person to vote for president. You know, I'm going to choose that, you know, because I'm going to look at how they are going to, you know, how they will choose, you know, how they will appoint some of the lower court justices and, indeed, you know, some Supreme Court justices if, you know, a couple of folks should retire or whatnot. So it definitely is one factor.
Has it brought you to the conclusion of voting for one candidate or the other already?
Yes. Yes. I'm definitely going to vote for Senator Kerry. He certainly seems to be more supportive of disability rights than President Bush, and will certainly, I think, and I've, you know, heard from some of the things on his website, will tend to vote for justices who will uphold our civil rights as people with disabilities and will initiate programs that will guarantee our right to be out in the community and to work, you know, to have real jobs, to function as real citizens, real tax-paying citizens in our communities.
Okay. Anita, thanks very much for that comment.
Thank you.
But David Savage, it reminds me of the question, first of all, I think you said earlier that it's a little hard to predict if you pick somebody based on the issues today, who knows what the issues will be in 20 years when that person presumably would still be on the court. But the other question that comes to mind is the fact that the Senate has to approve these nominees by a two-thirds vote, it seems to me would tend to moderate some of the more outlying issues, because if you have someone who's clearly identified, for example, as being opposed to abortion rights, there's certainly at least a third or more than a third of the senators who would be opposed to that candidate if he had such a clearly stated position. So the Senate would seem to be a moderating this two-thirds required vote for approving.
Well, I think your general point is correct, Joe, that that who's ever in office, if President Bush, if he picks somebody who's an extremely on the far right, the Democrats, even if they're in a minority, will try to block that nominee. And the same goes the other way around. If Senator Kerry would pick somebody who's identified as an extreme liberal, the Senate Republicans would try to block that person. It is, by the way, only a majority vote. You only need a majority vote for confirmation to the
I don't know why I had it in my head
Supreme
that it was
Court.
Two-thirds.
No, there's various filibuster rules where you need more than
60,
a majority.
Yes, but just,
Clarence Thomas was confirmed on a 52-48
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's going to war, and maybe I think it's of the same. I just had it lodged in my brain. Well, that just shows you.
Let me go back to the caller's comment. I think she is, too, is quite correct to vote the way she's voting, just like your caller from Utah, I think, correctly discern what he cares about in his interest. Because it is true, the conservative justices of the Supreme Court, particularly Scalia and Thomas, have given a very stingy reading to the Americans with Disabilities Act. Almost every case that comes up, they take the view either this person is not disabled, or if he or she does have a disability, he can't win anything. For example, we had two cases recently where the issue was, did the state violate someone's rights, and could you sue the state under the Americans with Disabilities Act? One was a fellow who was in a wheelchair and could not get into the courthouse because it was only on the second floor. There were no ramps. Scalia took the view that even though Congress had passed the Americans with Disabilities Act and said this kind of discrimination was illegal, Scalia said the state was immune from, it did not have to follow the law and could not be sued. The state had a sovereign immunity that shielded it from any such claims. So people in the disability rights community see those, they follow those decisions, and they correctly think these justices are not going to be very supportive of the laws that I care about.
Well, we heard earlier from Stephen Presser from the University of Northwestern University School of Law in Chicago, who supports President Bush and feels that he's the right candidate to pick the next Supreme Court justices should that become necessary. Joining us with a different view about the future of the Supreme Court is David Strauss. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and a former Assistant Solicitor General of the United States, where he argued 17 cases before the court. Welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
So you have also have an essay in Legal Affairs in which you write that it would be much better for the law and the country if John Kerry made the next Supreme Court appointments. Why?
Well, I think there's a basic difference between the appointees Kerry would make and the appointees Bush would make. And I think your caller from Utah who said he's a conservative Republican and for him the Supreme Court is the only issue, I think in a way he really hit on it. I think the Republicans have a very clear agenda for the Supreme Court. They have some issues that they care deeply about, and they are issues that the Supreme Court can resolve for them, issues like church-state relations, gay rights, and the power of the federal government to regulate business and the environment. And they care deeply about those issues, and those are issues that the Supreme Court really can put out of reach for a generation. With one qualification having to do with abortion, which I think is really not a qualification in the end, I think the Democrats just don't have an agenda for the courts. I don't think a President Kerry would look at appointees and think, well, I want to be absolutely clear on how this person is going to vote on these issues. So I think from Kerry, you're likely to get basically moderate, slightly liberal maybe, pragmatic, case-by-case justices in the mold of Justices Breyer and Ginsburg, the two Clinton appointees. From President Bush, I think you're likely to get an effort to appoint judges who are as ideological and as in conformity with the views of the Republican base as he can get away with whatever the Senate looks like after the election.
So are you arguing that this is a case where not having a political agenda for the court is a good thing in terms of picking the best potential justice?
Well, I think it's a fact that Kerry doesn't have a political agenda. I don't think there's anything necessarily bad about having an agenda. The clearest agenda in the last century was Franklin Roosevelt, who had a very clear agenda that he wanted a court that would uphold his New Deal legislation, and he got one. So I think having an agenda in and of itself is not bad. I happen to think the Republican agenda is a narrow and exclusionary one, and I don't like it. But I do think it is a fact that that Republicans have much less to worry about from Kerry appointees than moderates and Democrats have to worry about from Bush appointees, because I think the Democratic agenda will be a legislative agenda. The Republican agenda, I think, in substantial measure, will be a judicial agenda.
You also write about something in your article called the Constitution in Exile. What is that, and why are you concerned about it?
Well, here's what I think is kind of a sleeper issue as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. There are a lot of conservative legal intellectuals, including some very smart, very highly regarded lower court judges, some of whom are thought of as Supreme Court possibilities, who take the position, which seems to me amazingly extreme, that basically the Constitution hasn't been enforced in this country for maybe 70 years, ever since those New Deal programs of Franklin Roosevelt, minimum wage laws, occupational safety laws, labor relations laws, security regulations, and then a little bit later, environmental regulations, laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act that came up in connection with one of your other calls. All those laws really shouldn't be allowed, and the Constitution just hasn't been getting enforced since the early decades of the 20th century. So these people say the Constitution's been in exile, and we ought to bring it back from exile. And I would actually expect to see that being a view gained that would gain increasing force on the courts and on the Supreme Court if Bush gets to make some appointments. I really think that is the battleground, not so much abortion, where I think the Republicans have kind of given up the fight, but just questions that I think most Americans take for granted as far as the scope of the federal government's power to try to improve people's lives. I really think that could come back onto the agenda if we have a second Bush administration.
Well, I'm just curious, what do you think would be the consequence socially if the Constitution in exile, if there was this return to the 70-year-old type of interpretation?
I would think a very substantial narrowing of the federal government's power to legislate in many areas, such as regulation of the environment. I'd expect to see some laws regulating the environment be declared unconstitutional and others be interpreted very narrowly. I'd expect to see increasing inroads on laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act. David Savage described some of what Justices Scalia and Thomas have been pushing for in that area. I'd expect to see more than that. A reassertion of property rights against both federal laws, acts of Congress, and state regulations. People want to use their land in a certain way that the government wants to forbid because it pollutes or because it threatens endangered species. In all these areas, I would expect to see more and more decisions being taken away from Congress and away from state and local governments by judges who say, no, no, the Constitution, the properly interpreted Constitution, not the one we've exiled for the last several decades, doesn't allow these forms of legislation.
All right. Thank you very much for speaking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
David Strauss is a professor of law at University of Chicago Law School and a former assistant to the Solicitor General. He spoke with us from his office in Chicago. We're talking about the Supreme Court, and David Savage, a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, remains here in the studio with me. We're looking forward to getting your calls at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. David Savage, let's see what else our listeners have as a question, and I'd like to go to Hank in Lake Tahoe, California. Hank, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your program.
Great.
My observation is, it is my understanding you do not have to be a lawyer to be on the court. My question is, has any non-lawyer ever been appointed?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Thanks for asking. What about that? Do you know historically the answer to that question?
I think the answer is no. I think there are, in the early days, there were lawyers, they didn't go to law school or whatever, but they all had some lawyer legal training. I don't think anybody was ever appointed who was not a lawyer, had no legal background.
But you mentioned earlier, and I wanted to follow up on this, Earl Warren, who was the governor of California before he came to the court, and it seems now as if taking somebody who's not already a judge is almost impossible to contemplate, but certainly that could happen.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That's one of the biggest changes in the Supreme Court over a generation, that if you look at the court, say, back in 1954 that made the historic Brown versus Board of Education decision, that court had governors, former U.S. senators, U.S. attorney generals, people. In those days, the Supreme Court justices tended to be people who had prominent roles and frequently prominent political roles, who were appointed to the Supreme Court sort of as a capstone of their career. Now, the classic Supreme Court justice is somebody who spent his or her whole career essentially as a judge on a federal appeals court. And there are pros and cons to that. I think one of the cons is you don't get people who have experience of being in Congress or being a governor, the sort of wider experience in the world. The pro, I suppose, is that the person doing the picking, if you're the president, you'd have a lot more confidence in picking somebody who had spent 12 years on an appeals court writing opinions. You'd sort of know what you were getting. As you know, the criticism way back when of, you know, Eisenhower, for example, putting Earl Warren on the court, he had no idea how liberal Warren would turn out to be. It was quite a surprise, and none of the presidents want to do that anymore.
Okay, Hank, thanks very much for the call. We have time for one more quick call. Tom in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, go ahead.
Yeah, I think Mr. Savage has hit everything right on the head there with this picking of Supreme Court justices. It just seems like Bush is kind of doing an FDR kind of thing where he is picking the judges according to his agenda. Now, do you think that, I mean, I believe it's almost impossible to legislate morality and to especially pull a judgment off one. But now, do you think in about 10 years, you think gay marriage is going to be something that will be brought up in the Supreme Court? I mean, back in the like 60s, a lot of people, majority of America, thought that interracial marriage was a huge problem. Now, do you think that's going to affect America the same way?
Tom, thanks for the question. David Savage, just have a few seconds left. What do you think?
The answer is yes, but it'll take a while. That yes, somewhere down the road, 10 years, 15 years down the road, I think the Supreme Court will say the same that persons all around the country have a right to same-sex marriage, but they will only do it once it's been basically established in three-quarters of the country. I don't think the Supreme Court will be too far out ahead of the country on that subject.
Okay, well, that's the end of this discussion on the Supreme Court. Thank you very much for being with us this afternoon. David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was here in Studio 3A. We'll look forward to your article in the LA Times. When is it going to come out? Do you know?
I hope this weekend.
Okay. Well, there's a reason to pick up the Times. When we come back from a short break, internet rumors spur Congress to take a vote on the draft. Plus, Arnie for president? NPR's senior Washington editor Ron Elving will join us. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.